Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Amanda Seyfried talks to me about her new movie, The Testament of Anne Lee, as well as her endearing love of Mean Girls. Morgan Neville is the Oscar-winning documentary maker who gave us the brilliant 20 Feet from Stardom. And he's also the man behind the brilliant new Paul McCartney documentary, Man on the Run. All about Paul McCartney, post the Beatles. And as always, we'll be telling you what to stream and skip. You can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. It's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you are doing well. Now, I just want to mention this week that regular listeners know I'm a Everton fan, and I made my maiden voyage to our, and I called it ours, like I own it, I certainly don't, but the new Everton Stadium, the Hill Dickinson, on the Mersey there. I took my eldest son, Hill Dickinson, my favourite firm of solicitors whenever I'm in Liverpool, but we were there for the Everton Man United match. And I know this is not a sports show and I'm not really talking about the sport, but by golly, it's a beautiful stadium. For any neutral listening to this, it's right on the river and they've just done a world-class job. We used to go to a place called Goodison Park, which somebody once said it was a dump, but it was our dump. Let's just say it was kind of a stadium out of time. It was too old, possibly. So the new one is absolutely beautiful. And you may know, if you have any eye on sport, that Everton lost 1-0 to Man United. And you know what? For the first time, my son, he's an Everton fan, all our family are, but he's probably, as much as any 13-year-old boy is, I'm not sure they care that much. But when you're in a stadium full of 40,000 screaming blue Scousers, you care. He was pretty distraught by the result. But I guess, you know, it'll prepare him for a lifetime of the slings and arrows of outrageous sporting fortune. And indeed, life. It's a good lesson. That's what I told him. Anyway, that was how I started the week. Now, to the business that you're really here for, movies and TVs, I do have to, of course, quickly mention, because I wasn't talking to you since the BAFTAs and indeed the IFTAs. Firstly, in the IFTAs, I was delighted to see Christie, the movie, won a whole load of stuff. We featured Brendan Canty and Danny Power, who stars in a brilliant Irish set movie from Cork. It's so Cork in the right sense of the phrase. We had an interview with the guys behind it last year. Danny Power, who plays the lead in it, in his late teens, negotiating a complicated life. It's a brilliant movie with kind of young hip-hop collective in it as well. It's a great film, so I was delighted to see it kind of clean up, as well as Hamnet and Jesse Buckley. And then in the BAFTAs, Jesse Buckley won, which is great, and lots of people won, and there was various controversies. But I just want to mention that Robert Aramayo won for Best Actor for the movie I Swear. Now, you may have heard about this week because it's based on the life of John Davidson. We interviewed Robert Aramayo for the movie I Swear, and it's a terrific movie, and I was delighted to see it do so well at the BAFTAs in the form of him winning, because he does a brilliant performance. John Davidson, you might have known who he was last week. You do this week because he was at the BAFTAs. He has Tourette's syndrome, and Tourette's syndrome, you know, there is a spectrum of how it displays itself, and John Davidson has a lot of verbal tics and says inappropriate things. And in the movie, I Swear, it is all about that. And some of them are very funny. And the filmmakers were fine with us kind of finding humor in that, because John Davidson said a lot of his life has been very funny. So I just want to say, I was delighted Robert Aramayo won for I Swear. Now, John Davidson is at the center of something that happened, in that he shouted out something involuntarily that was a great cause of concern and possibly embarrassment to people on the stage. And it's nobody's fault in terms of what he shouted out, because that's the way he is. But I am baffled as a man who has been in radio for 20 years plus and have produced lots of radio outside of my own. How on earth the BAFTAs, with the 2 hours to spare, were not able to edit out what he shouted out. It's just mind-boggling. To anyone who's in the manipulation of audio or visuals, who works in this industry and edits things before they go to air, I am absolutely baffled as to how the BAFTAs got it so wrong. When you have people who are paid to edit TV shows for viewing 2 hours later, it is mind-boggling. I've said mind-boggling a few times, so I'm frankly utterly perplexed by how that happened, but it did happen, and we shall see what happens there. But I Swear is a terrific movie that was in cinemas last year and is coming to Netflix shortly. Check it out. It is brilliant. And Robert Aramayo is a worthy winner, and I was delighted he won a BAFTA for it. Now, this week in TV, I was watching this.
I saw this thing, an app, DTF St. Louis. You meet these people so you can spice up your life, spice it up.
What's DTF?
Down to
Whoa. You work together here?
Yeah, Floyd was a colleague and a friend. How did you get into signing?
I have Peyronie's disease.
I have a curve in my penis greater than 30 degrees.
Profile name, rock solid.
Because I feel like I'm a pretty dependable person.
Now, that is a clip from DTF St. Louis, which starts on Monday. So you can't see it tonight, I'm sorry to say, but I really wanted to tell you about it. I got sent a couple of episodes. We have Jason Bateman playing a St. Louis weatherman called Clark Forrest, who becomes best friends with the station's ALS translator, as in the man who does the sign language on TV, played by David Harbour. After David Harbour's first day on the job, when there's a vicious storm and they kind of both survive it. And then Clark and Floyd kind of do the suburban dude thing and get to know each other and, go to restaurants together and stuff. And they also start to express a kind of, I suppose, malaise or dissatisfaction with their relationships, especially Floyd, who's grown, let's say, sexually distant from his wife, Carol, played brilliantly by Linda Cardellini. He's also stepdad to her troubled son. David Harbour's character, Floyd, is also working hard to shed some extra weight he's picked up along the way. Then one day, Jason Bateman and Floyd are sitting on a swing, and Jason Bateman's character tells him he saw a news program about a new app called DTF St. Louis. And DTF means down to sexual swear words starting with F. Suffice to say, it's one of those apps where people go for, sexual connection without frills, let's say. Now, Floyd seems a bit hesitant, but him and Clark agree that they're going to investigate it. Cut to a few months later, and one person of those three people I mentioned to you is dead. And then the cops show up, and chief among those cops is the brilliant Richard Jenkins playing a Donahue Homer. And we also have Joy Sunday playing Jodie Plum. And they sense, well, she does, that something may be wrong in this initially obvious crime scene. And then they go off and investigate a kind of sordid saga, I think it's fair to say. I don't want to say too much because it's very twisty. I've watched 3 episodes of this and it's great. It's a dark comedy. It's looking at, I suppose, suburban malaise or, the underbelly of suburbia, behind the white picket fences of suburbia. I'll stop saying suburbia, but you know what I mean. It's a look at middle America and weird things people might get up to while they're married and otherwise. David Harbour is brilliant in it. Jason Bateman, as a guy who does going off the rails in a seemingly happy life, he's untouched. He really is. All the main players in this are great. It's a great show based on the 3 episodes I've saw. It's not going to be on until Monday night on Sky Atlantic or Now TV, but do check it out because it's really enjoyable. The unusually named DTF St. Louis, starting on Monday nights on Sky Atlantic. Now, I want to quickly tell you about a movie that was released last week that we didn't get to, but I did get to see this week, called The Secret Agent, which has been nominated for a Best Picture, Best Film Award this year, and also for its lead actor, and rightly so. We have Wagner Moura plays Marcelo, a man on the run in 1970s Brazil. This is all in Portuguese. We begin with him driving across Brazil in a yellow VW Beetle, which irritates the local corrupt cops, and most cops in this movie are corrupt. He's a widower with a small boy, currently been looked after his late wife's parents, and his father-in-law runs a cinema, and there's a whole kind of cinema motif going along in that. So Marcelo's, it's hard to know what to describe him. Is he a dissident? Is he a political agitator? What is he? He finds he's going to have to get out of Brazil. Let's just say that. And it's not easy to do that. In a previous life, he was an academic working in engineering who found that a minister with kind of a private commercial connection wanted to shut down his whole department and benefit lucrative industry by a private company. The quarrel that ensued meant there's people hunting him, hitmen. So this is rightly getting lauded. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's a political thriller, but it's not like a John Le Carre one. It's not hitting you beat after beat. It's a slow burner, maybe novelesque or you know, it has that vibe to it. It's slow, but it's thrilling. Great watch, and rightly being given an Oscar nod this year. Wagner Moura, who's an actor and a filmmaker from Brazil, is brilliant in it. He has this face that seems eternally optimistic, even when the world is giving him bad shots. I really enjoyed this. It's still in cinemas. That's why I'm telling you about it. So if you're in the mood for a meaty, albeit slow moving, but I don't mean that as a bad thing, political drama with great acting at its core, then The Secret Agent is a damn fine watch. And as I say, it's still in cinemas. And talking of cinemas, we did run a competition last week for three lucky winners to go and see the new Disney Pixar movie, Hoppers. They were Karen Darcy in Meath, Padraig Keegan in Westmeath, all the Meaths, and Paula Conheedy in Dublin. Dublin 6. So they won a family pass for a screening tomorrow in Dublin for Hoppers. So I hope you enjoy that. I'm actually going along to watch that movie myself tomorrow. So do enjoy that. Now, after the break, I'm going to be talking to the great Amanda Seyfried about her intriguing new film, The Testament of Anne Lee. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, opening in cinemas this Friday, the 27th of February, is the beguiling and very strange, wonderfully strange movie, The Testament of Anne Lee. We have Amanda Seyfried starring as the real-life Anne Lee, who was the charismatic leader of the Shakers, a celibate Christian sect founded in England in 1747. They worshipped through ecstatic song and movement and kind of dance. Anne Lee had a kind of very tragic early life in that she lost four children and then became the leader of this, you know, the only way to really describe it, I suppose, is a cult or a sect. And they went off to America to try and establish a utopia for this kind of modern day Bethlehem on earth, modern day Christian celibate paradise on earth. The movie is really strange in a good way, in that we have Amanda Seyfried acting out Anne Lee's life, but with lots of these Shaker hymns and movements. And it tells her story from the early trauma that we mentioned up until moving across the water. It was written and directed by Mona Fastvold, who previously gave us The World to Come, who also co-wrote with her partner, the brilliant The Brutalist. It stars Amanda Seyfried as Anne Lee, as I said. Amanda Seyfried is, you know, one of the most famous actresses alive, I would suggest. She's been in everything from Mon Ami to Mean Girls, Mank. She was, of course, in The Dropout on Disney, a brilliant actress. So I got to talk to Amanda Seyfried and the director of The Testament of Anne Lee, Mona Fastvold, about their intriguing new film and a bit more besides. Hi guys, greetings from Dublin, Ireland.
Nice. Oh, nice.
Indeed. Well, it's not. It's a horrible day today, but in theory it is nice.
Oh, we just like the accent.
Oh, okay. Well, we're off to a winning start because I liked your film, so, you know.
Oh my God, that's funny the way you say it. I love that. It's great.
Mona, is it, like, I imagine the pitch meeting of this might have been tricky. You're going to make a movie about this fascinating woman from the 18th century who's going to sing hymns and travel across the seas. Like, it's a hard sell on one level until you actually see what you did with the movie. So I guess that's a long way of asking you, was it hard to get this off the ground?
It was really freaking hard.
Yes, that was hard. You know, I when I found the story, I thought, this is going to be great. What an amazing story. I got to hurry up and make it before someone else does, you know? And then, you know, I started pitching the film, trying to raise money together with my producer. And it was, people were just puzzled, really puzzled. It was very difficult. We raised the money, just one person at the time. And there's just an incredible group of people who supported the film. But it's many small checks. But then once we made it, then, of course, there were a great appetite for it, which was, I mean, I knew that, or I hoped that, but I, you know, but you obviously you never know. So it's always scary when you're making a film that you literally feel like people are saying, do not make this movie.
Yeah.
Like, please don't. Like, this is just too strange. And then you make it, you're of course wondering if that's going to be the, you know, the same response, but thank goodness, no.
No, it won't be. Well, I'm glad you persevered with it. Amanda, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I was thinking, like, you've done plenty of things in your career, and I actually just remember this morning I interviewed you for Mank about 5 years ago. So you've been doing this a while, but there's an awful lot going on in this. You're singing, you're in the depths of despair, you're on these coal boats, which I believe were in Gothenburg. Like, was this maybe the hardest thing you ever did? Like, looking down your filmography, I could see how it might be.
Yeah, I think it's up there with Mank. I mean, in terms of the fear of in terms of the challenge of the playing the character, portraying this particular type of person, it did feel so foreign to me at first. And I think I've learned that the more foreign it feels, the better the challenge, the better the outcome. Mm. And it's very transformative. Obviously, anybody who faces their fear is going to feel incredibly capable on the other end of it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I look for in my work. I just I think, you know, you say all these things, cold and being uncomfortable, but I used to let that discomfort really wash over me when I was younger, and now I kind of I utilize it in a different way. And so, bring it on, I guess. I mean, there's a clear vision, and when you're being led by someone with such a clear vision and, you know, and passion, then it's really you can't really go wrong unless you drop the ball. And I was never going to do that.
Yeah.
No, you didn't. Either of you can answer this, but I was thinking, I'm a father, and, you know, the horror of all our lives, I think, is losing a child. Poor Anne loses four. And my take was, the reason she's become fanatical, for want of a better phrase, is the loss of those four kids, because that's unimaginable. So that's when I watch this movie, and it's the only thing I know about her, really. That's why I think she was such a firm believer. But what do you guys think?
Yeah, it directly correlates to,
yeah, of course,
to her place in the world. I mean, it's when someone could just fall apart, and, like you said, let it devour you. That kind of grief, you kind of have to, like, decide quickly what the reason behind it is, and what your greater purpose is in life. If it's not going to be motherhood, how do you stop the pain? How do you overcome it? And she chose a very specific path, and she was unrelenting, and that saved her life, and it saved her, and it ended up, you know, obviously creating a space for a lot of people. But yeah, absolutely, the trauma.
Yeah,
I don't know if she would have. I don't know. I can't imagine the celibacy thing, the part of the movement, the religion is directly in correlation to the fact that, like, you're most likely going to lose your child if you have sex. If you have sex and get pregnant, which you probably will, there's no contraception, you're going to lose your child, and you're going to have that kind of suffering. And she wanted to prevent that.
Yeah.
But so it made sense.
But it makes sense. I mean, you have to see that part of her journey in order, I think, to empathize with where she ends up. But the film is not about that trauma. It's, you know, that it's a part, it explains why, where she ends up, but it really just kind of sets up her journey. And that was important to me. I didn't want to, I didn't want to indulge at all in that part of the story. It's 9 years of her life, and it could have been a whole movie, just that. But I thought it was, you know, there's a lot of stories that are told about this specific theme. So I thought I'm not so interested in that. I think we've explored that a lot, and I think I want to explore the story about a person who actually goes through this and then become instead of being passive, which of course is a natural response to a lot of grief, is to be passive. She is the opposite. She becomes active. She forms a freaking religion. She starts fighting for equality between gender, and she builds the largest utopian society in American history. That's what she does with her grief,
she,
you know.
She puts it to use. Amanda, just in closing, it might seem a million miles away from Mean Girls, but in a way, you know, Mean Girls is often described as a kind of proto-feminist kind of movie or something like that. So I don't think these movies are the same in any way, but I'm just wondering, we had a prime minister during COVID here called Leo Varadkar, who actually quoted lines from Mean Girls during one of these many speeches we all watched. I know, bizarre. And I actually was saying that to Rachel McAdams a few years ago.
What did he say?
She's like, really? You know what? I'm trying to rack my brain.
Oh, he said on Wednesdays, you wear pink on Wednesdays?
It was something along those lines. Yeah. But I'm wondering now at this remove. Why do you think that film has continued to have such a life that, like, Irish prime ministers mention it during COVID?
Incredible. Well, I think it's just like it's saying what everybody's thinking in a very unique way. I think it's like it's taking down the bullies in the cleverest way. You know, it undermines their power, and I also think like I will just say that it's not Anne Lee and Karen Smith from Mean Girls. Both are very, very committed to their idea of the world, and it kind of helps them, completely miss the drama. Like they're just like they are who they are, and they aren't judgmental, and they just are, you know, just kind of welcoming to whatever's coming at them. And so I will say I do find a correlation between those two characters, but I think Mean Girls is just if watched correctly, I think it's a really great take on bullies and on teenage girls and the power that we have over each other if we use it. In that way.
Yeah, there might be a future college thesis. I can hear it now, the correlation between those two characters. Someone will get busy with that. Anyway, we are out of time. Congratulations on the film, your directorship of it, and your performance in it. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Cheers. Bye bye.
I had the most astonishing visions. The whole spiritual world was displayed before me. Loss of all suffering and the mystery of all evil revealed. This is the vision I shall carry in my heart.
A clip there from The Testament of Anne Lee, which is now in cinemas all across Ireland from this Friday, the 27th of February. Amanda Seyfried was discussing Mean Girls there. I got the quote wrong from the former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. He actually quoted the line about, "My answer is that the limit does not exist." But the fact remains, he did quote Mean Girls, and Amanda Seyfried and indeed Rachel McAdams seemed very pleased when I mentioned it to them. So there we go. That is Amanda Seyfried and Mona Fassbault, who direct and star in The Testament of Anne Lee. Now, up next, I'm going to be talking to an Oscar-winning director, Morgan Neville, who gave us the brilliant documentary 20 Feet from Stardom about his brilliant new, I'm using a lot of superlative adjectives there, brilliant, but it is a brilliant new documentary all about Paul McCartney called Man on the Run. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, have a little listen to this.
I had fear of being a grown-up. I felt very depressed, but I was very lucky because I had Linda.
Whoa, beautiful.
I said, if I form a new band, do you want to be in it? And she kind of, yeah. Okay, well, we've got two members. We started Wings from square one.
was Paul McCartney of Wings.
It was about trying to do something different.
What am I doing singing with Paul McCartney?
When did you first discover Linda could sing?
On the wedding night.
Yes, the sound, the voice of Paul McCartney, and indeed a little of Linda McCartney, from a brilliant new documentary called Man on the Run, which got a slight cinema release last week, but is on Prime Video from this Friday, the 27th of February. Now, look, I could eat this stuff for breakfast and watch it all day, but I think you will love this if you have any interest in the Beatles or indeed Sir Paul McCartney. This is a documentary about, I suppose, his decade from 1970 until 1980 when the Beatles broke up. It features him moving to Scotland, releasing some solo albums, forming Wings, doing some strange stuff from like TV variety shows, re-establishing his connection with John Lennon, some fascinating archival stuff in here. Paul McCartney was interviewed for it. This was a strange time in his life, but a fascinating time. He was, you know, one of the biggest musicians in the world, and then suddenly he was no longer a Beatle. So it was a really strange time. From then, Wings happened, crazy stuff happened there. They went to Nigeria and had to fly out of the country because it was all falling apart, their recording session for Band on the Run. It's a brilliant watch. I know a lot about the Beatles, but I didn't know half of this stuff. There's some really interesting insights about him and John Lennon and possibly even appearing together on TV one night. It's called Man on the Run. It was directed by the brilliant documentary maker Morgan Neville, who gave us all sorts of things, but a lot of you will know the brilliant music documentary 20 Feet from Stardom, which won an Oscar, which is all about these backup singers who were, you know, 20 feet from the main man or the main woman and the lives they made as singers. He also did that brilliant Steve Martin documentary from last year or the year before, Steve Martin in Two Pieces. He just makes brilliant documentaries, and Man on the Run is no exception. So I spoke to him earlier in the week via Zoom, and I began by asking him, I suppose, why Paul McCartney wanted to do this, because it seems to me that Paul McCartney has talked about the past ad nauseum and in a way would never want to spend hours sitting for a documentary. But let's find out.
It was Paul's idea, actually. and the idea was simple, which is there a film to make around the Wings period? And that's what Paul's manager called me originally, God, almost 5 years ago,
right,
and said, Paul's interested in maybe revisiting the Wings period. Are you interested? And I said, absolutely. And as somebody who's watched every Beatles documentary and read every Beatles book, I actually thought that this was an interesting period that was less explored. Mm. But also, I think my interest and Paul's interest in this actually came a little bit out of the Get Back project, because you know, Peter Jackson's kind of retelling of the Let It Be sessions in 1969, that kind of snapshot of where the Beatles were. I think that experience of making Get Back allowed Paul to revisit that time and realize maybe he wasn't that much of a bastard, you know, because I think in his memory, everybody just, you know, particularly if you look at the original Let It Be film, the way that's edited, it's all the bad stuff and none of the good stuff. And what you see in Get Back is, you know, good and bad and, you know, friction and humor and everything together. And I think that opened the door for Paul to maybe say, you know, the 70s were hard in a lot of ways, but maybe it wasn't all bad either. And I think for me, the question that kind of motivated this film was, when you see Paul in Get Back and you see him there, he's so creatively in the zone. I mean, his songs are pouring out of him and he's pushing the band to do things. And you kind of wonder what happens the day after that stops.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where the film begins, essentially, the day the Beatles break up, which is what do you do when that's all you've ever known? And Paul suddenly has to ask himself these huge questions.
Yeah, there's a lot of revelations in the movie, but one of the senses I got that I never really had before, there's this idea the Beatles break up and they're all so relieved because stop doing the stuff that they all had to do. And I always thought Paul was the most relieved of everyone, that he could go off and, you know, do whatever he wanted. But he was really kind of terrified, wasn't he? Like, he seemed more lost than any of them. That's what your film seems to attest to me. But what's your sense of that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. That, you know, John Lennon says in the documentary that Paul was the one that wanted the Beatles to stay together the most. Mm-hmm. And in the early 70s, you know, right out of the gate, out of the Beatles, Paul's the one who's flailing the most, the one who's the most lost.
Yeah.
You know, and they're, you know, you hear Elton John in the film talk about, you know, John Lennon puts out Imagine, you know, and other things. And
yeah.
George Harrison puts out All Things Must Pass, you know, and all this whole backlog of songs he couldn't get the Beatles to do, which, and it's an amazing record. And and even Ringo's having great success.
Yeah.
And everybody's thinking, what happened to Paul?
Yeah.
And I think the music Paul starts making, particularly if you look at McCartney and Ram and Wildlife, the first three records he does, they're so out of sync with what people were thinking in 1970, 71, 72, that they were kind of reviled. But at the same time, they did sell a lot of copies, and now through time, those films are those albums are kind of beloved. You know, now an album like Ram that was lambasted is considered one of the greatest albums of all time. I mean, specifically Rolling Stone magazine trashed that record, and now it's one of Rolling Stone's top 500 albums ever made. I think Paul was just out of time. He was out of sync with what was happening at the time, and people were kind of angry at him for it.
Yeah. One of the other revelations was the idea that him and John, when they start getting back together in the mid 70s, were going to go down to Saturday Night Live that night on spec. Like, you just can't help how different the world might have been had they. Did you know that, or did he tell you that?
I've heard that story before.
Okay,
so I knew, but I'd never heard Paul's full version of it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Paul and John had flirted with getting back together at different times. There was talk of John maybe coming down to visit the New Orleans where Paul was recording Venus and Mars, that record. But then John got back together with Yoko and that never happened. But then even later on in the 70s, other people have told me that that both of them had talked about doing something. And I mean, this is pure speculation, but I think had John lived, they would have played together again.
Okay.
You know, I know, I just feel like it was all going that way. The rapprochement was so strong, and that connection, you know, that they were both thinking about it.
Yeah. You know, he'd had convictions, and we see the Japan thing for dope and all, but he, at the same time, he always seemed like the straightest one of the Beatles in some ways. But another thing in the documentary I hadn't realized, and it's kind of almost intimated, but he talks about having a dram of whiskey one morning and then says, that was nice, have another. And I shouldn't laugh, but was he lost in booze for a while? Because I wasn't sure. It was kind of hinted at, and maybe that's just the way it should stay and it's none of my business or anyone's, but.
No, I mean, I think Paul has talked about it some, that it, you know, there was a period immediately after the kind of private breakup of the Beatles. So it's really, if you get into it, in September of 69, John in a band meeting says, I want a divorce.
And
I'm done. And Paul, within 2 weeks, is living in Scotland in this little farmhouse he bought as a tax dodge with Linda. And he's depressed, and he is drinking too much, and kind of trying to figure out if he's even going to make music. I think that period of time is not very long. You know, I think it's, you know, less than 2 months. Because by the end of 69, December, he is back in London and starting to work on his first album. So I do think there was a dark period, but Paul, probably being as eternally optimistic as he is, I think he turns pretty quickly. And as he says in the film, it because of Linda too.
Yeah. That
Linda wouldn't let him indulge too much in his own, sadness about it.
Yeah.
That she really tried to make him realize that it could be an opportunity for him too.
We see some of the weird things he does, like the TV show, the kind of variety show. You know, I love Paul McCartney, never met him, but I was cringing watching some of that. Like, he's a man out of time. He really is. You know, they're tearing down the streets with Johnny Rotten and he's doing these variety shows. Does he have a cringe about that now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. he said there's a lot of really embarrassing stuff in this film. And I said, yeah, but it kind of shows his journey. You know, I mean, really, for the first few years of the 70s, nothing is really going quite right. You know, and we talk about him putting out, you know, Mary Had a Little Lamb as a single. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, was because he had a young daughter named Mary and that he was spending his time with young kids. But, you know, I think if he had had a manager, which he didn't even have in the beginning of the 70s, somebody would have said, you know, Paul, maybe you shouldn't do that. but another song that he puts out too, which is not in the film just because they don't all fit, was Give Ireland Back to the Irish.
I know. Yeah. That's an awkward one.
You know, but all of these are kind of awkward. I think he's trying to figure out who am I as an artist if I'm not a Beatle now. Yeah. And I think really by 1973, he kind of figures it out finally. Yeah. And I think part of it has to do with that's when the troubles with the Beatles kind of wrap up.
Yeah.
You know, the acrimony kind of ends and, you know, the lawsuit that he had to extricate himself from Apple ends. Mm. And I think, you know, starting with Live and Let Die, but then through Band on the Run, you know, he kind of figures out this is who I am as an artist.
Yeah. And Band on the Run, the way it sounds in the film is just, this is his moment. The music from that album sounds brilliant in the film. I don't know if you did anything to it, but it just dances off the screen, you know, and you go, my God, what an album that was, as if we needed reminding.
It is. And we managed to mix the film at Abbey Road and we mixed it in Atmos. So I do have to say, it sounds incredible.
Yeah,
so.
It really does. It really does. Listen, let me just ask you about one or two of the other things that I really liked of yours. The Steve Martin doc I thought was terrific. And, you know, as a child of the 80s, he was a big star that we all loved. Again, maybe similar to the Paul thing, but he's quite a private man. And in the movie, you know, his daughter, we don't see her. She's kind of animated. He was very keen on that. And yet we see him reading kind of a script, John Candy lines, and he gets emotional. All whatever about Paul, was Steve Martin a hard guy to talk into revealing so much?
Yes, I mean, Steve has always been a private person, but Steve, I think a combination of Steve having done therapy for so many years, and I think the fact that he's a father now, I think he really just is a softer person now. And I think realized that this was kind of the one and only moment in his life where he could open up in that way. And to some extent, you know, he had lived such a life as a comic and then a movie star and everything else. And he has this young daughter. In a way, it's kind of capturing his story in a way for his daughter, I think.
Yeah, okay.
And in a way, I feel like often what my job is, if I'm making a film about a living person, is to hold up a mirror.
Mm.
You know, that I'm taking in what I can and then kind of showing what I see.
Mm.
And often I think I show the subject something that they have never quite put together. And I'll say, when I showed Steve Martin the documentary for the first time, his first comment to me was, can I show it to my shrink? So
that sounds like success to me.
I have to say, as a filmmaker, that's the best compliment you can get.
And then just finally, and you've been gracious with your time, I'm sure there are lots of names doing the rounds who might get the Morgan treatment, but I'm just curious. Bob Dylan, would you ever approach that? Has it ever occurred to you? Because you're talking about notoriously shy people. I mean, I've been to his concerts and it's like, who is this guy? And I mean that as a compliment, but have you ever thought of that? Have you ever approached him? Or it's fine if not, but...
I mean, I'm such a Dylan fan, but I mean, he is a man of mystery. Yeah. And I think that's been central to him. And even the documentaries he's done, the Martin Scorsese documentary, yeah, No Direction Home.
Are strange ones in ways, yeah.
They're strange. They're never straightforward.
Yeah.
And, you know, his books, but particularly the first one, Chronicles, like, I love that book. Mm. But it's elliptical, as he is, you know. Yeah. It's... I mean, I would love it if I got a call about that, but I don't think it could ever be straightforward.
No, I can't imagine him sitting down for 4 hours with you going, tell me about Tangled Up in Blue. Yeah.
No. But they're all their unique challenge into themselves. So, that's part of what I love about the job.
Yeah. Well, look, we look forward to the next one. In the meantime, the current one, Man on the Run, is absolutely terrific. I thought I knew it all, but it's delightful. And I gather our very proud countryman of ours, Paul Mescal, was at the premiere and loved it as well, because he's a lot of Beatles skin in the game as well. So congratulations and continued success, Morgan.
Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Morgan Neville there talking to me about, well, not working with Bob Dylan, but his brilliant new Paul McCartney documentary, Man on the Run. And it's a great watch, and it's on Prime Video from this Friday, the 27th of February. That is it for this week. If you want to get in touch with the show, screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Thank you for listening. Leave you with a little music from the movies. We got to finish with Paul McCartney and from Band on the Run. This is the glorious 1985, which I guess could just be called 1985, but it is technically called 1985. So this features in the brilliant new documentary Man on the Run. So I'll leave you with that. Wish you a happy remainder to your weekend and talk to you all next week.